This is RÚV English Radio with Darren Adam, daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.
Hello, this is RÚV English Radio. I'm Darren Adam. Thanks very much for your company. I'm in the northeast of Iceland today. I'm at the Sauðaneshús Cultural Centre, which is looked after during the summer months by my two guests today. Well, I'm their guests, in fact, in this wonderful house, Other Lawyer and Starkathur, who are two artists who, during the summer, look after the building that I'm in just now and invite guests in to have a look round and learn about life on this peninsula, this very remote part of northeastern Iceland. Thank you very much for having me today.
Yeah, well, you're welcome.
So tell me about the room that we're in firstly, which you said was the main room. This is what guests see first as they learn about life on this peninsula.
Mm-hmm. This is the biggest room in the house. It's the south office, I guess you would call it. This is where the priest would entertain guests.
This was the vicarage, house,
where the priest and their families would live. Mm-hmm. And it was a working house. They would, you know, the priest's office over here. You take guests here. You have workers going up and down. This Sauðaness was like a hub, was a center for this northeastern area.
And priest partners would often teach the local children to read and stuff like that. So it would be kind of a hub.
It was like an integral part of the community. Right?
So I guess before we get into this room then, when would that have been? When would this have been a much more bustling and busy center than it is now?
It's in the middle of the 1800s was maybe the peak. This house was built 1878.
29?
Yeah, 29. Took a few years to build. So this was like the culmination of this history. There's been a church in Sauðaness since 1100. So, you know, it's always been a, until, you know, maybe the Second World War, around then, it was always a very popular place to try and be a priest in. There was a lot of people that were living here, living off the land, working for the farmers, for the priest also, obviously. This house was like the culmination of that, but eventually sort of the new age caught up with them. And the sad thing about the house is kind of, it wasn't in use very long. It was built in 1878. And by 1957, they had moved out because it just didn't fit with the times. It was difficult to modernize. It was cold.
The emigration center in Vopnafjörður talks about how specifically people moved from that town and that part of Iceland to America and to Canada. And life here on this peninsula, it feels to me as if it would have been maybe even harder than that.
Yeah, I agree. And you can see by the statistics that that the most people that emigrated to the Americas came from this northeastern part of the country. So life must have been very difficult. The weather is sometimes brutal and the nature is quite barren in places. So it would be understandable. But people also had probably other reasons.
Yeah, I mean, when this the new life in the city beckoned, you know, when you could maybe have a chance to do something else other than farming and
and maybe workers' rights.
And maybe a little bit more freedom. Then it was very desirable to go, and there was a huge, you know, the percentage of the population that left here was enormous. It's kind of crazy to see.
Well, let's talk about the house that we're in and the way in which it reflects the life that people led. Let's start with eggs, talking about birds. And they're making a hell of a racket today, by the way. They're being really noisy today.
Oh, those are other types of birds.
Yes, yes.
The loud ones.
They're very, very loud. Well, so tell me about these eggs here.
These are eggs from ox, or what we in Icelandic call blackbirds. They live in the cliffs here in Langanes and in Iceland. And these would have been like real commodities, these eggs and the birds who lay them.
They're about twice the size of hen's eggs. They're quite big.
Yeah, and they're quite salty and kind of, how would you describe the taste?
Yeah, it's just like if a chicken lived in the sea, it's like a sea taste.
It's the start of a joke, isn't
it? Yeah.
Chicken lived in the sea.
But there's still, there are records of people going into the cliffs and getting these eggs, It's always like a specific time when the eggs are ready and the birds have come. It's that the people here would follow the nature, obviously, just in that how they would gather, and at what time they would gather the food, the eggs.
And here you can actually see an old illustration of a person going down into the cliffs.
Gosh, yeah. So it's almost like a cartoon, isn't it? There's a man descending on a long rope of some kind, being fed down by people at the top, down towards the bottom to collect these eggs. But this was a matter of survival, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a very important food source. This particular text this source is from the Westman Islands, Westmanet. Mm. From the 1500s, but what I think what's special about the cliffs here is that they were much more accessible. It's not so difficult to go out, go down into the cliffs to get down there. Obviously, it's very dangerous and still very dangerous today, even though we have modern equipment. But at the time, there was no question about it. You had to go get those eggs to feed your family and feed the people around here. And they obviously ate them fresh, but they also stored them in salt, in vinegar. Yes.
And you've got some of the containers they might have been kept in, some of the ways they might have been preserved, presumably, over here.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And it's also important to note that that the eggs were a commodity that the priest could get revenue from.
Yeah, they would sell access to the cliffs, for example.
And then sell the eggs,
yeah.
So what you need to know first and foremost about Sønes is that the priest here would have been a really rich man.
A powerful man, by the sounds of it.
It was a desirable position to be in, yeah.
I don't know what he charged, but was it affordable for people? Was it resented that they had to pay money to collect the eggs?
I think so. I mean, there are instances of people trying to sneak in and like somehow unlawfully collect eggs, maybe without a rope, just climbing down into the... There are many examples of that in the sources, which I think says, you know, something about how things were going on at the time.
But you can also see from his history books and logs of possessions of the priest that this would have been very important to them, this going down in the cliffs and collecting the eggs, because you can usually see that the priest would own at least one harness that was like logged in there.
Yeah, it was made from leather, and you can get a rope today that's very long, but back then, you know, in the 1400s, 1500s, to make a 30-meter long rope was difficult.
It's no easy time.
Yeah, it was made from leather, I think, as well.
Yeah.
And you would have to make it in a specific way. It was very expensive. So
the priest would own something like that.
Yeah. Are these eggs still collected here?
Yeah, they are collected in a much more smaller scale and maybe a little bit safer.
They have helmets now?
Yeah. they do it. I think now the main cliffs, which are have the most eggs or the most accessible, are owned by the municipality here.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of rent them out to people if they want to.
Nothing changes, does it?
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's basically a question of tradition now. I don't think there's any
survival.
No. Yeah, and I don't think anyone's making maybe too much money off of it. But
no.
I mean, it doesn't look like it would be unless you charged a huge amount of money for the eggs.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like it would be an easy way to make money.
No.
Oh, no.
No. And it's very dangerous still. The we have this man, actually, who we have a picture of here in the museum, from like a modern way of collecting that. He actually was injured
in an accident
a few years ago. The most dangerous thing, it's not actually falling or anything like that, you know, like the obvious thing that you would think was dangerous about it, it's the fact that your rope might catch on something up above you and loosen it, and then it falls on you.
I mean, he looks like he's performing a rescue. He looks like someone has fallen down onto one of the shelves, and he's on the ledges, and he's going down with his high-vis jacket and his helmet to try and rescue them. He doesn't look like he's collecting eggs for people to eat.
He's a guy that's done this a lot, and he's done this before, and he's very able. So he's ready for anything, I think.
Yeah. When was that taken? How old is that photo? It looks like it's been there for some time.
A few years ago.
Three or four years ago. Well, that was one food source, one way that people survived here many years ago. But there's more to this house than the room that we've just been in. Where would you want to take us next?
Maybe in here.
Mm-hmm. where we have some more of the birds that are common to this area. There's a theme, but we're at a desk now with a lovely old typewriter. We have a drawer full of, what is that? It's not fur, it's down, is it?
Eiderdown.
Eiderdown,
yeah. This was the main income source for the church here in the area. There's along the coast, there are specific places which are very packed with eiderbirds.
Nesting
eiderbirds. And it's the same thing with the birds. There are sources going way, way, way back, telling about how they would collect the down and then sell it, even abroad. It was it's very expensive.
Yes.
It still is
very expensive.
It still is. I remember I went to the Eider Center in Stykkishólmur, in the west of Iceland, where you can buy pillows and duvets.
Yeah.
And my goodness, the softest thing I've ever touched.
It's incredible. And if you, like, you could just put it underwater without doing anything to it, and it just repels water, and it scrunches up really, really small, but then you let it go, it goes right back.
And the ducks just throw it away. They don't need it.
They leave it behind ultimately, but it serves a purpose
for
their eggs.
Obviously,
when they're keeping their eggs warm, especially important here, and when it gets very cold. They have been collecting the eiderdown here for hundreds of years and using it and selling it.
Also on the desk, let's talk about some of the items that are here then. There is a beautiful clock, which I think dates back some time. There's a top hat. There are some spectacles. There is an oil lamp, I guess. These are items that would have been in use in this house?
Many of them are old belongings of some priests that lived here and worked here. But also in this installation, we tried to put items that kind of represent the wealth that culminated in Sauðanes. And here you see a lot of objects that very obviously were not manufactured in Iceland, such as the clock, which is probably from Germany or Denmark, I would be guessing. And that is a big sign of wealth, I think, in Iceland, if you can have imported things.
At that time. For sure, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But this was the priest's office for most of the working life of the house. And yes, all of these objects are somehow connected to one of the priests that were working here.
And we have a female figure in national dress of some kind over here. What's happening here?
And this is actually a dress of a priest's wife, Þuríður Hólmfríður, who was the wife of Arnljótur
Ólafsson, who's maybe one of the most famous priests here. Yeah.
He was the first economist?
Yes, he has this... he's sort of... I don't know if it's officially or unofficially. He was the person who wrote the first book of economics in Icelandic.
Yeah.
And he was a politician. He was a very powerful man. And his wife made this beautiful...
I don't know if she made it, but it was hers.
Yeah.
Is this the national dress? Is this recognized as a form of national dress?
Yes, it is. And you can actually see in a picture here, she's wearing it.
This is a wedding here in the area. This is, I think,
wedding his daughter.
Yeah, his daughter is getting married, and they're all here in their best dress, and she's wearing this exact outfit.
Black dress, the gold belt, and there is
a silver belt,
a veil around the side of the head, and what would we call this at the top on her head?
Tiara.
I wouldn't say it's a crown. It's not quite a crown.
Yeah,
it's a tiara, I think. She's well dressed anyway, certainly.
Yeah.
But it's one of the things that, because we get a lot of foreign travelers coming through here, and they're always sort of amazed, because you feel like you're in the middle of nowhere, out in the end of the world, you know? And it's always interesting, the reaction when you tell them, this was like a center of
enterprise.
Of enterprise here at one point. And then you point them maybe in here and tell them about the stress. And, you know, there were priests in here working. They were reading Latin and Greek and
English, German.
And French. You know, doing very normal, in quotation marks, things for people. But it's just in this very remote place.
It's a contrast that you both get to see as well, because you live in Reykjavik for most of the year. But here, during the summer, you are the caretakers of this building. You look after it. You invite people in. You show them around. How does that feel in your lives when you get away from Reykjavik to come here? Are you glad to get back to the capital? Do you look forward to coming here?
We're pretty lucky in that we have two lives.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've been coming here for almost 10 years now. And we didn't, like, at first, we didn't really imagine this being our life's work.
Well, yeah. You look almost shocked that it is, that it's happened.
It happened by accident, I think.
Yeah.
We were just looking for a job after we graduated from university.
And, okay.
And just sort of tried it. And then, yeah, it was...
We really loved the tempo and the
There's
life.
There's great people here. And, it, you know, I've lived abroad and I've lived sort of, yeah, all over the place. But it, when I'm living in Iceland, I always just lived in Reykjavik. So I had very limited experience of the countryside.
Mm.
So, but it just...
I forced you here.
Yeah, kind of.
At the time.
Yeah. But it's just to see that, I think it's, I mean... It used to be in Iceland that young kids would go to the countryside on, like, regularly to work, maybe one, two summers when they were younger. I never got to do that. And it, like, our generation doesn't do that. But
really.
I think, it for me at least, what was interesting was just to get to know the people that are living outside of Reykjavik. You know, it's it's just like a silly thing to say maybe, but it's so interesting because we always get asked... Oh, isn't it like strange being out all you know, all the way out there in the middle of nowhere, and you know, it takes such a long time to get there, blah blah blah. But like, you know, nobody thinks like that. Where if living here, you know, it's like a completely normal thing to live here. You know?
Iceland is a big country geographically. It takes up more area than people outside of the country think. We're always being asked, as those who come from the UK originally, how big is Iceland? And people are surprised when you say, well, it's about the size of England, you know, in terms of how much land it takes up. And coming here to the east today from Reykjavik, yes, I could have driven, but it's faster to fly. It's 45 minutes as opposed to 8 hours. So people don't necessarily recognize that this was such an important place. And that it's possible to have a great life in places like this.
Yeah, of course, of course. It's
And of course there are difficulties in being so far away from Reykjavik or like bigger cities or towns in Iceland. Mm-hmm. But it also like adds certain things that you wouldn't get in...
Yeah, there are opportunities here as well. I mean, we would never have... Like, because we curated this exhibition along with a few other people, obviously. And we got that experience here. We got that opportunity here. And it would have been probably unlikely that we would be doing that in Reykjavik. You know, there's a certain amount of, like, you know, if things need to be done, then you go and do them, you know. There's
when there are fewer people, every person counts more.
Yes.
Everybody here, or what we feel like, is that everybody here is just glad that there's somebody that wants to do something.
Yes.
And especially when they're doing something for the community, I think people are very thankful for that.
And when you get visitors here, then what do they make of what they see here? Do they have expectations about what they're coming to see, or are they surprised?
Well, it depends. I think the people coming from abroad are very surprised. And especially, like, you know, this whole, the house itself is, the foundations are made from stone. It's from stone, but everything inside of it is timber and it's driftwood. And people come in here, you know, maybe from Norway, where there's forests everywhere, or Finland or something, or Canada or whatever.
Or Siberia, where it all floated over from in the first place.
And they're saying, like, oh, wait, this is all timber. This is all made from wood. And you tell them, yeah, it's comes from the beaches, you know. It's like, and, you know, I think people don't know what to expect coming here.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the sort of the locals that come over, the Icelandic people that come over, they often have like some sort of family connection or something to the place, to the house, to the area. So, and that's, those are sometimes the most fun visits, because then they're coming, telling us something.
Yes.
They're telling us about, my uncle was the guy who built the church or whatever. There's something, there's a connection that they're coming, bringing to us, which is very fun.
Yeah, the people that you met leaving the museum just now, they were descendants from a priest that used to be here.
Yes, there's a previous guest that were just leaving as I was arriving.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And he was a priest here a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they still talk about their roots here. And
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, because it's like in a museum, if we work in a museum in Reykjavik or in some other big city, It's just kind of like a nameless sort of, it's work. Yeah, maybe you meet one or two persons, but like everyone who comes in here, because there's not so many people that come, you always start talking to them.
Yes.
And so that's kind of the fun part of the job, is you're sort of just always talking to different people about their traveling and it's always surprising for us as well. You're talking about like, you know, what are people expecting when they come here? For us, we don't know what to expect from the guests as well. There's been, for example, a lot of Western Icelanders, we call them people who emigrated, the descendants of people who emigrated to Canada and to North America, that have come back here with just like a name on a piece of paper. Oh, this is my great grandfather. And then they ask us, like, do you know this name? And then we, like, sometimes we can just, you know, look
sometimes
them up in a book.
Yes.
And yeah, this is his from you, this is a hat or something, you know. So. Yeah, it's like it's a privileged position to be in, to sort
yes.
of. Yeah.
It was actually one such visit was very sad, because there were two guys that came in here with names on a piece of paper, and they said, "Oh, we don't know, but these guys were brothers, and one of them was my great great grandfather, and I think, or my family thinks, that he built the church here." But he was in quite a hurry and really wanted to see the church, which we got to show him the church. But I looked at the books after he had left. He was in a bit of a hurry, as I said. And it turned out that his great-great-grandfather had actually built this house.
Oh, my.
And he was gone, and there was no way for me to tell him that.
I wonder if he's listening to this.
Yeah, it would be great.
That's what I'm hoping, to get this information out there.
Yeah,
but
when was this?
This was a few years ago.
This is a few years back, maybe 5 years back.
And he was from?
I'd say Canada.
Okay.
But maybe like North Dakota or something like that.
Let's throw that into the mix then. If you are listening to Roof English Radio somewhere in one of the northern states and you were in Southern S about 5 years ago, it's possible that your grandfather built the house that
we're
standing in.
We have upstairs, we have a little narrative about the brothers that built the house. And
okay, let's head upstairs then.
Yes. Driftwood is quite interesting.
Oh, the driftwood
if you
part of the exhibition first.
Yeah.
This is the second workbench that I have seen today. The museum in Ilstadir has an exhibition, permanent exhibition, about life in rural communities. A homemade, if you will, workbench such as this one that we're standing in front of. But this is designed to manipulate driftwood, presumably.
Yeah. Well, this is just like a standard Swedish bench. But this was the bench that they used when they were renovating the house in the 90s here. So they donated that to the museum as a sort of a
prop. So it still works.
It still kind of works,
yes.
It's seen better days, but it's, it gives an idea of what's...
Sturdy enough.
Yeah, exactly, sturdy enough. But we are in the setting in the driftwood room, which is interesting, mainly because there's not a lot of information about driftwood available in Iceland. There's not many museums that sort of... take on the subject. So
we had to go a real roundabout way of finding information, actually. I feel like
I guess we start by prefacing that by saying there's not a lot of wood in Iceland because because of the deforestation that went on in ancient times. So a lot of the wood that is used to build houses like this would have been driftwood.
Yes, almost exclusively driftwood,
And before we were talking about commodities like of the land that the priests would have sold out, and one of the commodities from the land was this driftwood, which was extremely valuable at the time. So in the area also there were a lot of good woodworkers because of the access of
And we mentioned Siberia earlier as one of the sort of places that it comes from. In fact, here's a handy map, thank you, which shows us the driftwood patterns. Where else is the driftwood coming from then to end up here?
It comes mostly, I think something like 80-90% comes from Siberia, and even more specifically from this river, the Yenisei River.
That's some distance, isn't it?
Yeah, it's some distance, and it takes, well, it depends on if you think it's quick or slow, but I would say it's pretty quick. The path from there to here takes on average around 6 years, according to the study that we have are basing this on, which is kind of the only study, the sort of large scale study of driftwood in Iceland. But there are some pieces that come from maybe from like Alaska, or, you know, it depends on how, like how the weather was that year. But you know, people think it comes from Canada or something like that. It's no, it's almost exclusively from
And Iceland's in a great location to benefit from all of that, because there are lots of different flows, it seems here on this map at least, that the wood can come from.
Yeah, it's basically a sort of straight line from there to the sort of northeast. It's even better. Yeah, there are specific places in Iceland also that are better than others, and that's one of the reasons why the church or the landowners that own the land, they needed to be kind of close to it, to sort of police the coast and make sure that nobody else was taking their driftwood.
Is it still used, maybe not in the same way that it was, but is there a modern use made of the driftwood that comes here?
Yeah, I think that's exactly true. It is still used quite a bit, and the farmer here, for instance, uses it quite a lot for building and fence posts and and such, but it's not used to the degree that it was, because you can just go to Biko and get some cheap fir or something.
I must admit, when we needed some wood recently, that's where we went. It wasn't it wasn't to the beach to pick up driftwood and to militant and to craft it ourselves.
I mean, there's still a lot of driftwood lying about, and some of it is quite old, and some of it is quite good. Some of it obviously is very bad and it's rotting and all that, but there's still resources to be had. Yeah, as you said, the farmer here and the next one over, they use it a lot.
But it is there is less driftwood now than there used to be, partly because the process of driftwood floating here is that the wood comes from this river here, and the Russians are regulating their
they're more efficient at not losing because in the used to be, you know, they would cut the trees down and float them down a river on barges, or even just floating the timber down the river, and every once in a while you would, you know, lose one too, like, you know, there'd be bad weather, and
so that's how it got into the system.
Then they eventually got better at, you know, collecting all of everything that they
And some driftwood comes in a more natural way. There's a tree that gets dislodged in bad weather or something like that, but mostly it's like this way.
Most of it is kind of like pollution, really. It's kind of like man-made driftwood that sort of finds its way into the sea ice, and it travels with the sea ice most of the way to Iceland, and then it's only sort of the last sort of tiny bit that it actually floats along and drifts onto the land.
Iceland, of course, will be making almost no contribution to this. It won't be unless driftwood floats back out again from Iceland, maybe.
We're lucky that way.
But yeah, it is interesting. It follows, obviously, if there's less sea ice, there's less
driftwood. There's less driftwood. Well, let's head upstairs on these wooden steps.
Yes.
You go all day, you know.
To the part of the museum, part of the exhibition that you mentioned a few moments ago. I'm not very good on narrow stairs, by the way, so just
take care not to bump your head.
Yeah. I will try very much not to do that. So we're heading in here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So we have another writing bureau here as we walk in, and there are panels with photographs of
various individuals from this area. And in here we have two bigger rooms, and we thought in our installation that we would dedicate the rooms. One of the rooms is dedicated to working people and like normal people from the community, in quotes. And then the other room is dedicated to the priests that would have lived here, and their partners and families, which are of course also of interest to people who visit this museum. But so we like we're trying to make the exhibition about everyone, not just a select few.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much history here. It's very difficult to, you know, we're never going to be able to talk about all of it.
So we've got it's a harpsichord, I think, isn't it?
I think that's what it's called.
And this instrument on top, langspeak?
This is something that came from the house. This is this is an instrument that is connected to the place. One of the things that the priests had a privilege to do, they had time to leisure. And a lot of the priests here were poets, okay, or historians.
They were, of course, educated.
And yes, they knew how to read and write, which was not a given at the time, obviously. We have, like, one of the priests here was the man who made the little poem about the months, Abjumseftnov, which all the school kids in Iceland sort of used to remember the
days of the
months, of the year. Yeah,
are we gonna hear that recited?
Abjumseftnov þrjátíu hver, eitt til hinri kjósa sér, fyrir brú tvenna fjórtán ber, frekar eitt þá hlaupur er.
Just explaining also when the leap year is.
Yes, so I mean, that is April, June, September, November, 31 days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 30 days, 30 rather.
Days. Yeah.
One for the others.
None for the others. Yeah. February has 24.
Two times 14.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And one more if there's a leap year.
I need to brush up on my numbers.
But so this room is kind of a history of the priests that lived here, and also their families and their partners, who were also very interesting women. Many of them were also learned, and many of them were basically doctors and midwives. But they are cited as homeopaths or just good at healing. Or something like that.
Those skills were played down, weren't they? They really weren't given the credit that they deserved.
No, definitely not. And they, as I said, were also sometimes teachers, teaching children to read and such. And but their skills, as you rightly said, are played down in history books. And it's also very hard to find reliable information about what the women were actually doing.
Yes.
'Cause they had a home to run and other duties.
Mm-hmm. And also on this floor, I think you said, we learn about the two brothers who
who
built this house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were working men, of course, carpenters.
One of the brothers was the one who built this desk.
This is the writing bureau, the writing desk we're in front of, yeah.
This was the desk that he built as his sort of graduation piece when he was becoming a learned carpenter.
He passed, I hope.
It's
pretty beautiful.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's really. And if you, when it opens, it there's like a mechanism, and it's quite
it's
perfect.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's interesting. But the thing that we're talking about here, and what his story kind of tells us, is he was a well known carpenter here. He was working a lot, doing many things, very respected in the community. But even then, he took the decision to leave for America. There was nothing here that specifically held him here in Iceland. So he is an example of, like, you know, even if, you know, there was a lot of immigrants that wanted to go because they just had no other choice. It was the only thing that they could see saving them. But even people who were relatively well off here took the decision to go and would try to find a better life in the West.
So the two brothers that built this house, Sveinn og Brynjólfur Björgólfsson, they emigrated, and so did Isak Jónsson, who built the church that you can see here. So
you can also imagine, like, if you're living here, all of a sudden, like, the three carpenters have left the area.
Yeah.
And
it's a great loss.
Yeah, it's a really big loss. And just, they went, one of them went in one year, and the next year the other guy left. You know, it's very difficult to imagine being in that place. Like, everyone is just kind of leaving.
Yeah.
Things are really bad. And if you can't leave yourself, then you're just kind of stuck sort of in the middle.
Well, that's it. If you're not able to do what everyone else is doing to solve the problem that you have, your problem gets worse, doesn't it?
If there's suddenly no carpenters left as
and
well.
There's no carpenters,
you know,
then.
Here is a photograph, actually, of people leaving here. You can see Fontur, which is the edge of the peninsula, here in the background.
And there's about 40 people, 40 or 50 people on that
that
ship, maybe more, as you say, yes.
Yeah.
And this is somewhere in the middle of the 1800s?
Yeah, so around probably turn of the century.
Okay.
1900, yeah.
And so where were they headed to then? The US?
They would take a couple of stops. The boat would maybe leave from Vopnafjörður, stop here, stop in Húsavík or something, and then they would go. Or the other, I think maybe it was actually the other way around. They would go the south coast.
And some went via the UK, of course. Some went via Liverpool, which would make the journey even more lengthy.
Yeah, yeah.
In Hofsos?
There's
a museum about emigration in another part of Iceland where we saw information about where the Icelanders were going. So they were going many places, and some ended up in South America or Australia. So that's actually
a big subject, and there's so many histories that are just lost, like nobody's telling, which is kind of interesting that I think there are there's more info about this in Canada, in America than there is here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they're very interested in their heritage, rightly so.
Well, you are rectifying that here, though, I think, aren't you, with the work that you're doing. So tell me when people can come to see this. We're having our conversation just at the end of June. Mm-hmm. This conversation might be published sometime after that. So when are you open?
We are open every summer from the 15th of June till the 15th of August. We're open every day except Monday from 11 to 5.
Okay, well, I heartily recommend a visit. I mean, you're both artists as well, so just quickly, do you get a chance to, in this beautiful location with a bit of peace and quiet and sort of time to yourself, do you get a chance to be artists as well?
Well, we did more before we had a baby.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, when we started out, that was the plan, is that, you know, we would come here, we would work, but we would also have time, you know, to work on our own stuff. But as soon as, you know, two lazy about artists come to the area, they're sort of, you know, we were immediately sort of, you know, sucked into the community here. So there was like always a bunch of stuff to do and to help out. And there's
I'm going to take that as a no.
Yeah.
Mostly
if you want
mostly
to have a very busy time, constructive time, then come to Longanes.
Yeah, I think last few years we've taken a summer vacation from art a little bit.
Yeah.
And just do other things.
There's plenty of time.
There's
plenty to do.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much for taking the time today, both of you.
Problem.
Very much appreciated.
Yeah. Thank you for coming.
Details of Southerness up on the website, on the page accompanying the show from RUV English Radio. I'm Darren Adam, and you can get in touch anytime. We are english@ruv.is.
There is more from RUV English, with all the news from Iceland in English at ruv.is/English. RÚV English Radio is a daily English language radio from Iceland's national broadcaster, RÚV.